After seeing the cherry red stain on the slip of pH paper I held between my tingling fingers, no one else in my group of scientists and adventurers volunteered to touch the water at our feet. I was straddling a small trickle bubbling out of the tundra and disappearing again into cracked earth in Alaska's Western Brooks Range. Alaska's Arctic generally evokes images of gin-clear streams cutting through untrammeled valleys marked mostly by caribou hooves and wolf paws. Instead, black-stained dead tundra rolled down the hillside, where orange water flowed between dead alders and willows. 550 miles northwest of home, in Anchorage, and perhaps 300 miles from Alaska's road system, this corner of the northwestern Arctic is remote, even by Alaska standards. We were here to study waters like the acid spring at my feet and how climate change is reshaping the Arctic. This is our story. I'm Alex Lee.
And I'm Simona Capisani.
And this is A Hostile Climate.
On this episode, we're going to be talking about the nature of change.
When it comes to climate, this means many things. Change is scientific, but also emotional and relational. It's about the world, but also about how we interact with the world.
We're going to explore the nature of change by talking about a fairly recent phenomena of Alaskan rivers turning the color of rust. So on that, Alex, what were you just reading at the top of the episode?
I was actually reading the beginning of an essay I wrote about some research that I was involved with this past summer. Rivers in the Arctic are becoming acidic through a combination of mainly iron and sulfuric acid leaching into the water. Ultimately, the cause of this is climate change, and researchers are still pinning down the specifics, but there's already pretty widespread concern that this is happening across the Arctic and that there's increasingly widespread ecosystem degradation because of it.
So we're going to return to actually hear the rest of that essay that you wrote later on in the episode, but first we're going to have a chat with Patty Sullivan.
Patty's an ecologist and director of the Environment and Natural Resource Institute at the University of Alaska Anchorage. I know Patty pretty well. We spent 2 weeks together this past summer in the Brooks Range studying this phenomena. Patty's one of the lead researchers that I was helping with this project, and he's just the person to talk to about this.
So before we jump into this, we thought it'd be helpful to kind of just give that 30,000 foot perspective. So if you had to give a kind of top line summary about what you're learning right now about rusting rivers or why people outside of the Arctic should care about this issue, what would you think is the kind of the most important thing to say?
I guess I would say that in the last 5 years or so, beginning in 2019 and 2020, we saw a rapid proliferation of the occurrence of these orange streams throughout the western half of the Brooks Range. And it's almost certainly the result of anthropogenic climate change. And for me in particular, I found it really striking that these areas that we've deemed worthy of protection and that represent some of the last great wilderness in North America, if not on the planet, that these protected areas are being severely impacted by our activities indirectly as opposed to directly. You know, the protections are in place to prevent direct impacts, but our indirect impacts are showing up in their they're much more dramatic than we expected.
So we'll chat in a bit here about some of the work we were doing last summer, but we were on a wild and scenic river in a national park. So we were in a place that, if anywhere, is sort of set aside as special. That place is set aside as special. And we saw this really extensive degradation in the environment. Why do you think it took so long for this to be noticed? And why is this not the kind of phenomena that has sort of garnered more attention? Because it is a really widespread, pretty remarkable change on the land.
Yeah, well, I think that it's really just emerged recently. There are, you know, some examples of streams in the Brooks Range that have shown hints of this, you know, going back decades even, but the you know, they kind of have turned on and turned off, or it's just been like one stream in, you know, this area where, you know, all the other streams are still running gin clear. And so I don't think it really captured people's attention until this sudden proliferation in 2019 and 2020. And yeah, it's worth noting that that emergence of tons of these orange streams, it followed in the wake of two relatively warm summers, but especially two winters that had much deeper than normal snowpacks.
When you were saying about, you know, people taking notice, is that predominantly researchers that you're thinking about, or in terms of like the community of who first started to detect this? You know, in general, I'm just curious about what compelled you in particular to go out on the trip, you know, and look this up, and also, you know, who maybe is first starting to notice these things, particularly during this proliferation of multiple streams that you were just mentioning.
Yeah. I mean, the first folks who tend to observe these changes in the Brooks Range are the bush pilots, who are basically flying over the landscape every day. And you know, some of them are a little bit more observant and curious than others, but they're always the first ones to notice. And it's just a question of whether they recognize the significance. And so the progression for us was, you know, the pilots started to see it. They mentioned it to us. We were working in the area on a project looking at vegetation change, in particular advance of the northern tree line. And, you know, and our pilots basically tipped us off that, you know, the salmon in particular, which Alex was talking about before, this wild and scenic river in Kobuk Valley National Park, you know, as we were flying out there to go do our tree line work, that our pilot was like, hey, you guys know that this river is like, it looks like sewage all of a sudden. And so we were like, oh, interesting. Like, we need to like float out that river after we finish our work. And, you know, while we're in there doing our work, we need to be able to like drink clean water. And so initially for us, it was kind of like a logistical challenge, you know, but also, you know, I had really looked forward to going to the salmon. You know, it's kind of a famous river as far as like remote rivers in Alaska goes. You know, it was the topic of chapter one in John McPhee's Coming into the Country, and, you know, is described as this super pristine, gin clear stream with like, abundant fish, both salmon and Dolly Varden and grayling. And Alex and I are both fly fishermen, and so I was excited to, like, I brought my fly rod with me. And, you know, on the flight out there, our pilot Jared was like, yeah, I don't know how much fishing you're going to be doing, because yeah, you can't even see your feet when you're standing like in a foot of water.
And this summer, I think you told me maybe it wasn't worth bringing mine.
I know. Yeah. And I was wrong about that. Like, I'm glad you did. Yeah. I mean, just your observations of like where you were catching fish was, I mean, really valuable to, you know, help kind of understand.
It wasn't good fishing, though, to be clear.
No.
It was interesting fishing, but it wasn't good fishing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't the sort of thing that you write a book about, unless it's like a journal article for, some sort of scientific publication. But yeah. Cool to see that the fish were basically finding ways to survive in that system, and in some ways almost even taking advantage of the cloudiness of the main stem of the salmon. It was an area that I was excited to go to, and then was kind of disappointed to find that it had become so degraded. But the magnitude of the change was such that, you know, we felt like even though we aren't hydrologists or geochemists, we felt like we needed to do something to try and at least start the process of understanding why this change was occurring and what the consequences might be.
You've been doing work up there for 20 years. Have you ever seen anything that you would say is sort of as remarkable or as like visceral a change that you can see on the land as this phenomena?
No, it's the most dramatic thing that we've seen. And this is a landscape that's changing dramatically. And so it's particularly striking that this change stands out in the context of a whole bunch of other changes. You know, we're seeing trees moving further north and further upslope. We're seeing a lot more like tall woody shrubs moving into the area. We're seeing thawing permafrost and thermokarst, which is basically the settling of the ground surface. And, you know, we're seeing range expansion of lots of different plant and animal species. You know, we're seeing like black bears, for instance, in areas where it used to be just grizzly bears. Salmon are moving into streams that were traditionally not really salmon streams. And so there are all these changes going on, but like this rapid degradation of the water quality in many of these streams is by far the most visually dramatic.
One of the most dramatic things for me this summer during field work was what we didn't see. So talking about some of those changes on the land and particularly wildlife changes, we didn't see any big animals on that trip. We saw a couple of sheep, but we didn't see any bears. We didn't see any moose. We didn't see any caribou on a river that sort of has historically been known as this hotbed of life. And, you know, we can't say why we didn't see what we didn't see and who knows, but that sure felt like a bizarre experience.
Yeah, it's really striking to hear you say, Patty, and, you know, chatting with Alex a little bit about this, about like literally in a landscape. And, you know, the Arctic captures this imaginary, I think, with narratives around climate change, that it's the place where you'll see the most extreme levels of the impacts and the most quickly. And yet, in light of that kind of context and that kind of narrative, I think about climate change, you then still get surprised, right, by the degree and the rapidity to which that's changing. And I'm just wondering, in light of that, are you looking to maybe try to continue to study this elsewhere? Or also, does it make you feel like you need to try to do some other kind of, you know, remote searching around for other kinds of shifts that may not be on the radar and maybe either associated with this or just maybe a different way of how you're even approaching inquiry?
Well, I mean, I guess one thing that's kind of come from this is that, you know, we're now prepared for like surprises. In our previous work, we had felt like most of the changes that we were going to see were like the ones that were fairly predictable and the more incremental variety, you know, where things are kind of like slowly moving in like a new direction. But this emergence of the Orange Streams really just kind of highlights for us like the potential for like sudden, dramatic, and unexpected change. And so, yeah, I think we'll be looking for things like that moving forward, and we'll be less surprised if we see them. But initially, that was a big surprise. And yeah, we're trying to move forward with the work right now. You know, we've done a lot of water chemistry over the last two field seasons, especially this past summer. We had a small grant from the National Science Foundation, which funded just the one field season this past summer. And so we're still kind of like actively seeking funding to continue the work next summer and beyond.
You sort of shared a little bit about the origins of this project with some of the other work you were doing and seeing this change. Would you share a little bit about what the goals of this past field season were, what we were doing up there this past year, and if you've learned anything from that data set yet, or what you're hoping to learn from that data set?
Yeah, sure. So what we did this summer is we pretty intensively sampled two areas in Kobuk Valley National Park and immediately to the west. And when Alex and I were out, we traveled on foot from this area called Timber Creek up through a watershed called Tuckpulirik, and then basically crossed over a number of tributaries of the Salmon before ultimately descending the Salmon and sampling its main stem and all of the tributaries. And so that we went to this area because it's one of the most heavily impacted. We knew that the Tuckpulirik was heavily impacted, and we knew from our previous trips into the Salmon that it was one of the most heavily impacted. But our goals were, I guess, to identify both in the tundra and in terms of the tributaries, where the sources were. You know, is it just like one tributary, for instance, that's primarily responsible for, you know, the degradation of the Salmon, or is it multiple tributaries? And what, you know, geologic units are those tributaries coming out of? And what do the sources actually look like in the tundra? And so we spent a lot of time kind of exploring tributaries and trying to like locate the ultimate sources in the tundra of these seeps that were basically producing acid waters with really high metal concentrations.
Is there something that you're hoping, or you want to prioritize, I suppose, in terms of next steps, given this last trip out and what you've been focusing on, or any hypotheses that you think are worth chasing up before others?
I think we're still trying to kind of nail down like the geologic determinants of where in the landscape streams are vulnerable to these changes. Ultimately, what we're seeing is, the primary driver of these orange streams is essentially acid rock drainage, which is analogous to what you see in mines, where we've basically broken up rocks and exposed sulfide minerals to weathering that were previously unweathered. And that produces sulfuric acid, which then mobilizes a wide range of metals. We're still working toward understanding exactly which geologic units in the Brooks Range are capable of producing this phenomenon as the permafrost thaws. Getting closer and have some hypotheses, but it's an area where the geologic maps they're fairly coarse, being a remote region. And so there are lots of subtleties that just don't appear in the maps that we have, and ultimately will probably require some on the ground, like sleuthing to see exactly which rocks are present in which areas. But so that's one goal. And you know, the broader aim there is to basically be able to predict which streams that haven't already been affected might be vulnerable in the future. And then just kind of like expanding beyond northern Alaska to get a better appreciation of the prevalence of this and the potential for it in other Arctic regions.
Hearing you describe these things, I'm just thinking about it in terms of communication, right? Like these ideas about climate change being incremental, right? Or the slow, ent march that tree line advancement, tends to invoke.
The creep of change.
Yeah, exactly. Is really not the case. And it's actually much more dynamic, in the kinds of ways we've been talking about. Do you find that when you speak to people just colloquially or non-experts that helps you to convey certain things? I mean, I know that maybe, there's maybe goodness or badness or judgments about that kind of rapid shifts might be a separate question, but have you seen any kind of shift, I guess, in you being able to talk about it or communicate about it to other people, or I don't know, just shift the way that you communicate, I guess, about your research in climate change?
I mean, I think that it gives us like a little bit more of a sense of urgency, to see these dramatic, like nonlinear, unexpected changes. The very incremental vision of climate change and the impacts of climate change, I think, can give the sense that, what's the big deal if we wait a year before we, try and reduce our emissions? It's just like one more like micro increment toward this, undesirable state. Like we can just figure it out next year or put it off until the next administration or whatever. But when you see these like sudden dramatic changes emerging, I think it really heightens the need to act quickly before the whole system basically starts to collapse. That's really what we're seeing in these orange streams, is like it's an example of ecosystem collapse. And it's probably not reversible. It's one of those things that like once you basically like get that train heading down the tracks, there's no stopping it. It basically just needs to run its course.
Yeah. And I'm curious, sort of with some time away from this season, what you'll say, but what did it feel like to be in the landscape in that change this year? A place that you've been going for a long time that you sort of know has been changing, but traveling down the salmon from the gin clear headwaters to where it is, that bright orange sort of stew. What's it feel like to you?
I mean, it feels sad to me. I have a pretty good sense of what I unfortunately never floated the salmon in its entirety before the change occurred. And so I don't have firsthand experience of what it was like. I wish I had had that opportunity, both for scientific reasons and also personal reasons. But I have tons of experience from kind of analogous streams in the Western Brooks Range. And like they, when they're unaffected, they're like, they're the clearest water you've ever seen. You can see the smallest pebbles in, 10 foot deep water. You know, it's just like, it's gin clear is what people say. And so, you know, kind of like losing that amazing kind of like beauty is like, and the healthy ecosystem that is associated with it is, yeah, it's sad. And I worry about the, you know, the people who live in the villages that are downstream from this. I think they, to some degree, still don't quite know what's coming. But yeah, the Kobuk is pretty well aligned with villages. And those people depend on salmon and caribou and all of these wild food sources to survive, you know, way off of the road system. And yeah, I'm concerned about the future of those resources and their ability to maintain their subsistence lifestyles.
Rusting rivers. For me, things began in 2009. I stopped along a creek high in the Brooks Range, puzzled as clear, cold water turned iron red. I was 8 days from the road on my first trip to Alaska, and the river was bleeding. 14 years later, I know why. Climate change. The rusting river I encountered was in the Koyukuk drainage in Gates of the Arctic National Park. It was just one of the many rivers and streams that have turned red in the past decade and a half. This began slowly in small creeks, indistinguishable from naturally occurring background levels of acid rock drainage, a process of iron and sulfuric acid leaching into water and oxidizing red. But while iron-rich water does naturally occur, rust has shown up in Arctic rivers at a rate and scale unprecedented in modern times. Satellite imagery shows that since 2008, rust has flushed through river systems never before affected across the Brooks Range. This building change impacts water quality, invertebrate abundance, bugs, fish, wildlife, and people reliant on affected river ecosystems. Acid trip. One reason such a large-scale degradation went mostly unmonitored for so long is that it's unfolding in such a remote and difficult place to study. Aside from being a long way to travel, the mountains of the Brooks Range are a complex and difficult terrain to work in. Much of the year, an Arctic winter grips the landscape in cold, dark, and snow. Only one road cuts through the range in the 600 miles from the Canadian border to the Bering Sea. Tight valleys make even bush plane landings hard to come by. The expanse, range, and impact of helicopters makes detailed work difficult by rotor. This leaves traveling by foot and boat the best ways to access and study the land. Ankle-biting tussocks, walls of alder, steep rocky mountainsides, grizzly bears, swift water, maddening densities of mosquitoes, and a complete lack of any maintained trails all further complicate the matter. Such a landscape requires any images of scientists holed up in labs standing over beakers and chalkboards of equations be jettisoned. I joined a team led by legendary adventurer Roman Dial and Arctic ecologist Patrick Sullivan. Roman is a biologist and colleague at Alaska Pacific University who first noticed the unprecedented rusting, like me, by chance. After decades of northern exploration, he recognized this was something new. Patty, a research professor at the University of Alaska Anchorage, noticed the same from his many years of fieldwork in the Northwest Arctic. Our work this season was the first extensive on-the-ground scientific look at Alaska's rusting river phenomena along a full river system, from headwaters to mouth at a mainstem waterway. We transected an affected river ecosystem in the Kobuk Valley, taking water samples along the way to measure acidity, metal content, turbidity, and other impacts of rusting water. Roman also returned later in the summer with a team of geologists to further sample and understand the source and extent of the acid rock drainage. Acid rock drainage occurs when metal-rich sulfide minerals interact with water and oxygen. A bit like dropping a lemon wedge into a glass of water, making the glass taste sour, rocks heavy with sulfide minerals make groundwater acidic. This happens naturally at a slow background rate. But if you've ever seen orange and red water near historic mine sites, you're seeing this process sped up by human activity. Cutting into bedrock means that new space is created for groundwater to move into rock and out to the surface. This is akin to cutting up that slice of lemon in your glass. It becomes more sour. The chemical reaction that produces acid rock drainage also leaches heavy metals into the water. This is most commonly iron, aluminum, and manganese, but arsenic, lead, and many toxic metals also occur. like sugar in a glass of lemonade, some of these metals are dissolved into the water, while others precipitate out and form crystals in the water. It turns out climate change can also speed up this process on a massive landscape scale. Just like a mine cutting into the ground makes new space for chemistry, thawing permafrost means new interactions between water and rock. The frozen ground barrier between bedrock and surface water is melting, exposing rock to water and oxygen for the first time in many thousands of years. Permafrost was like the lemon peel and pith in our glass. No permafrost means all that pulp is now in the water, making it again more sour. The most affected sources we measured in the Brooks Range had water with a pH below 3 and specific conductivity of nearly 7,000. To put that in perspective, I spend much of the summer fishing, and every fall I clean my tackle box in a bowl of vinegar. Our most extreme readings were about what you'd find if you measured that bowl after using it to clean my pile of rusty hooks. There were 7 of us with a combined 150 years of remote wilderness experience out for 2 weeks in the field. We all knew the range, but Roman might know more hidden corners of the Brooks Range than anyone else alive. We quickly came to recognize the big seeps and tundra slumps, but he noticed the small changes too. Vegetation along the riverbanks changing, caribou trails choked by tall willows, how newly wet or dry the tundra was, and innumerable subtleties on the land. Precise and indefatigable, Paddy managed to keep his shirt clean to the last day. He showed the scientists' delight as measurements came in and the picture of what was happening came into focus. Forrest is another mountain legend and was one of my tent mates on the expedition. He spent a lifetime under big skies from Antarctica to the Himalayas. I credit Forrest with keeping the bears away from us with a jovial and constant stream of stories or opinions. He carried a lion's share and made miles fly by, talking about consciousness, morality, cowboy coffee, and the future of civilization. Now retired, Ray was a forester for 30 years and an ultramarathoner. He knew wild lands like he'd been there before, even when he hadn't. His skill set proved useful as we traveled 120 miles of wilderness while collecting data. Maddie and Russell are both grad students. They energized the group, carrying unbridled enthusiasm as well as most of the scientific gear. Far from greenhorns, the two 25-year-olds have spent the last 4 summers walking some 1,000 miles of this northern terrain. It didn't take long to find seeps of acid and metal bursting from tundra hillsides. The first week we spent sampling was by foot, following ridgelines and bear trails. We collected water samples and took digital readings of source seeps and affected creeks. The second week, we met a resupply plane, swapped out the filled water samples for pack rafts, and floated downstream to collect more. Roman was the conductor, taking notes and taking in the bird's eye view. Paddy wielded our digital water quality meter. Ray filtered water for samples. Forrest prepared vials. I collected sediment. Maddie and Russell counted bugs. Our samples will help show the extent and severity of rusting. Once my initial task was complete, I pulled out a fly and a bit of fishing line. I helped Maddie and Russell count bugs too. We never found any in the rust. I never caught fish in the affected streams either. As we walked and paddled, we looked at the land, the rivers, the rocks, and hypothesized about how things were shifting beneath our feet. Melting cut banks smelled like peated whiskey. An eerie lack of animals made the banks of this wild river feel quiet. We talked about climate politics, nature, and the philosophy of science. We tried to make sense of the immensity on the horizon. We still don't know just how fast the rust is spreading, how long it might persist, thousands of years, or what this means for the ecosystem. We do know from places like historic mining districts that as the metal precipitate builds up layers on river rocks, and as the pH drops, bugs run out of habitat and their populations decline. No more bugs means no more fish. The fish feed the bears fertilize the tundra feeds the caribou. As John Muir observed, when we try to pick out anything by itself, we find it hitched to everything else. We ended our trip in the Inupiaq village of Kayana on the Kobuk River. White people didn't make it to this area until 1900. No roads leave town, milk costs $17 a gallon at the only store to have it in stock when we passed through. The community here, along with their neighbors along the Kobuk, relies on fish and on the caribou. The immense landscape upstream is so far from the fast food chains and the noise and the conurbation of so much of the world today but it's still not free from the heavy hand of human influence on the planet. The more we know about how the landscape is changing, the more we will know about how change might impact people and communities on the front line. Since that first trip in 2009, I have fallen in love with the Brooks Range. The mountains are the ancient tale of the Rockies. The north slope of the Brooks reaches out to a vast coastal plain along the Arctic Ocean at the edge of the world, and the large rivers draining south pour life into the boreal heart of Alaska's interior. In recent years, a few routes have become more traveled, but it's still uncommon to see a human footprint even over great distances in the range. Most peaks feel wonderfully random. Char and Arctic grayling roll in nameless ripples. It feels like you could very well run into a mastodon, woolly rhino, or dinosaur at any turn. You would even be forgiven for harboring a suspicion that a unicorn is only ever one ridgeline away. And if you saw one, you would not be surprised. This summer, we saw no bears, no moose, no caribou. We did see four doll sheep ewes, a species in sharp decline due to changing winter conditions. Through just my small window into the landscape, I see change. It feels brushier than it used to. Change at the fringes always happens the fastest. I'm still left with hope for the Arctic because of its sheer size. So much of the land remains intact that there is a great reservoir of resilience against the creep of change. However, there's no water treatment feasible to reverse the current trend. Continued monitoring can help us understand how durable these ecosystems are in the face of global warming and what pieces might be most vulnerable. We can't tackle the climate crisis without understanding the impacts of climate change, just like you can't pay a bill before seeing the check. Even in the national parks and wild and scenic rivers in the Arctic, set aside as special places, climate change arrived without outside recognition or resistance. Heat waves, glacial recession, and species loss make for well-known headlines, but climate change continues to unfold in quiet, novel, and unexpected ways too. Understanding these impacts can help us adapt to changes, but also serves as a stark warning of global warming's far reach. Waiting for our flight home, it began to rain. Others in the group took refuge in the village office and talked with locals about the restaurant that used to be in the same building and about this year's late fish run. I stayed at the airstrip and took a nap in an excavator bucket. I dreamt of those unicorns and couldn't help but worry about their future.
Hey, this is producer Cody here to read the credits. Thanks for listening to this episode of A Hostile Climate. The show is hosted by Simona Capisani and Alex Lee, and it's produced and edited by me, Cody Nelson. Our theme music is by Mark Shapiro, and our show art is by Jean Julien. Additional music that you heard playing under Alex's essay is by me and M. Harlan Engelman. His music comes from the excellent album Rooms, Sprains, Slips of the Tongue, and I'll put a link in the show notes where you can hear and purchase the record. Special thanks this week to Protect Our Winters. They published the print version of Alex's essay, which you can read on protectourwinters.org. There are some photos of the research trip there too. A Hostile Climate is an independently produced podcast, and we count on listeners like you to help us keep making more episodes. If you'd like to donate and support the show, you can find information on our website, ahostileclimate.org. And please make sure you're subscribed wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what you hear, leave a 5-star rating and tell a friend. Thanks again, and see you next time.